Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you to another lecture as part of Einstein Fest this afternoon. We're delighted to welcome Walter Frisch. Walter Frisch is the Harold Gumm, Harry, and Albert von Tilzer Professor of Music at Columbia University, where he's been teaching since 1982. He received his BA from Yale and his MA and PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. His research interests lie in Austro-German music of the 19th and 20th centuries, especially that of Schubert, Brahms, Wagner, and Schoenberg. He is currently working on intersections of music and German modernism, 1885 to 1915. He is the author of Brahms, the Four Symphonies, the early works of Arnold Schoenberg, 1893 to 1908, and Brahms and the Principle of Developing Variation. He received the ASCAP Deems Taylor Awards for his writings on music in 1985 and 1990, has been president of the American Brahms Society from 1983 to 1993, and editor of the Journal of 19th Century Music from 1984 to 1992. We're very pleased to have him with us this afternoon. Please welcome Walter Frisch.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here tonight. The quote that I've put up as you contemplated as you came in is, of course, a very beautiful and suggestive one, and it certainly shows how close music and Einstein were and are. In fact, Einstein's mother, as maybe many of you know, was quite a gifted pianist. There was music in the family, and he started to study violin at age six. His second wife, Elsa, gives a rare glimpse of their home life in Berlin when she says, and I quote, "As a little girl, I fell in love with Albert because he played Mozart so beautifully on the violin. He also plays piano. Music helps him when he is thinking about his theories. He goes into his study, comes back, strikes a few chords on the piano, jots something down, and returns to his study," she said, unquote. One irony, perhaps, for what I'm going to be talking about today is that the modern music composed at the turn of the century was not music that Einstein admired. His tastes were distinctly conservative. So Wagner, well, I don't know about Wagner, but certainly Schoenberg, Strauss, some of the moderns would not have been to his liking. This photo, I thought I had discovered it for you, but I noticed it's in the festival brochure somewhere, but it's a wonderful photo that shows Leopold Godowsky, the pianist, Albert Einstein, and Arnold Schoenberg, the composer, at Carnegie Hall on April 1st, 1934. Three great wizards of the 20th century, Godowsky, one of the great virtuoso pianists, Einstein, we know, and Schoenberg, one of the great composers. And the occasion was a concert arranged by Godowsky under the auspices of the Council of Jewish Organizations for the Settlement of German Jewish Children in Palestine. And it was held in honor of Einstein, this concert, as a, quote, tribute of music to science. And at this event, Schoenberg's Verklärte Nacht, or Transfigured Night, was performed, an early work of Schoenberg, a string sextet. That was probably one of the few times that they actually met in person, Schoenberg and Einstein. In fact, there's an interesting story, that which I won't go into a lot, about attempts that Schoenberg made to contact Einstein back in Berlin in the 1920s and 30s, particularly concerning the Jewish question and the establishment of a Jewish state. They didn't see eye to eye on very important issues of Zionism and the foundation of Palestine. Einstein was a pacifist, and when it came time for the State of Israel to be created, suggested a compromise with Arabs and a kind of shared space. Schoenberg was a supporter of a more militant solution in the establishment of a Jewish state. And during World War I, he actually enlisted. He was much more a supporter of the war in World War I. So they didn't see eye to eye on those things. But earlier in the century, earlier in the 20th century, independently of one another, they actually tended to see and pioneer in their respective disciplines, physics and music, in rather similar ways. And that's relevant to what I want to say this afternoon about music in Einstein's world. As is well known, and I'm sure it's been repeated very often here, Einstein, in his 1916 book on relativity, begins his first chapter by asking his readers to question the truth, he puts in quotations, of many of the basic laws of Euclidean geometry. He goes from there to talk about motion and other aspects of physics, that points are not fixed in space, but are relative to one another or the viewer. And without wanting to push it too far, I would say that around the same time, in 1911, Schoenberg emphasized a certain aspect of relativity in music, somewhat similarly in his path-breaking Theory of Harmony, or Harmonielehre, book that Schoenberg wrote in 1911, where he questioned, sort of like Einstein, a basic premise on which most music had been based up until that time, which is an absolute and fundamental distinction between what is consonant and what is dissonant. This distinction between consonants and dissonance had, since at least 1500, been a basis of how music was conceived, composed, and heard. And it was seen in terms of laws, certain physical properties of sound. Schoenberg argued that the difference between consonants and dissonance was relative, and I quote from his Theory of Harmony book, "Dissonances are only different from consonances in degree. They are nothing more than remoter consequences. Today, we have already reached a point where we no longer make the distinction between consonances and dissonances." End of quote. That's Schoenberg from his Harmonielehre of 1911. And he was to go on in other writings to talk about what he called the emancipation of the dissonance from its sub-status and its being in opposition to consonants. And I think in Schoenberg's insight, which he drew from, he expressed it, but he was drawing on a tradition, particularly of Austrian and German music leading up to his time. In that insight lay the birth of much of what we would call modern music in the years around 1900. This was certainly true in what I would call the Austro-German tradition, from Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Wagner, Schubert. Very, very strong and prestigious, well-established tradition in concert repertories and in culture, and very well entrenched, that was becoming challenged by new ideas, new composers, new ways of thinking about music. But it also was true in other countries, I won't be able to deal with them all, other cultures, within Europe, France, Italy, Eastern Europe, Russia, and also in the United States. We could spend a lot of time talking about Charles Ives today, a contemporary of Einstein's, but we won't have a chance today. Instead, I'd like to organize my comments according to five different topics or areas, ways in which music in Einstein's world around 1905 questioned or expanded many of the basic presuppositions. And the works that I'll be referring to today were all composed within about a decade on either side of the Annus Mirabilis 1905, not all within 1905. The first category, if you will, or parameter that I'd like to talk about is that of musical expression. Romanticism in music, which had been around for some time in 1900, began to give way in the later 19th century towards greater extremes of expression in music. Eventually a movement called Expressionism. And part of this was had to do with a kind of greater psychological drive being manifested in music. That is, music expressing emotions and feelings not just of love or sadness, but of violent or extreme states of mind, even psychotic states of mind, and anger and rage. Music, you might say the musical language became developed in a way that could do that. This already starts with Wagner, for sure, in the 19th century. Indeed, Wagner was one of the first composers to speak or to write about that. He called it the subconscious, a music being able to express the subconscious, things that we were not aware of. And this is in many ways a precursor to Freudian thinking around 1900. If you think of Wagner's techniques of the leitmotif, having a motive that represents an object or a person or an idea, and if you know Wagner's operas, even if you don't know them, what happens is that very often the motive, the orchestra is saying something that the character might not even be aware of. In other words, we hear a motive in the orchestra and we recognize it because we're familiar with the motives associated, but the character, him or herself, or the characters might not be conscious even of what it is that we, the composer, has put into the orchestra we hear. So Wagner often thought of the orchestras having this role of expressing the subconscious. And there are moments of extreme violent emotion in Wagner, too. I don't know how many of you know the opera Parsifal by Wagner, but there's a moment where Kundry, this sort of half-crazed, half-sacred woman, screams, actually laughs. She screams and laughs, both, in that opera, very loud. She is actually, at the moment, she says, she's describing that in a former incarnation, she laughed at Christ on the cross, and she sings this word, lachte, with this, you know, the German with a very intense, really expressionistic way. So these things were starting to be done already in the 19th century. Around the turn of the century, that is around 1900, there was a number of composers, and I want to particularly signal Richard Strauss, who emphasized this psychological dimension in music, and particularly with a work that we can begin right in Einstein's Miraculous Year 1905, with a work that really sort of broke into the 20th century with extraordinary violence in a way. In fact, censors didn't even allow it on the stage in many, many opera houses. That is Strauss's opera Salome, which was based on a play by Oscar Wilde. And the play by Oscar Wilde, which was sort of scandalous enough, a vehicle for Sarah Bernhardt, with Strauss's post-Wagnerian music laid on top of it, had an enormous force and power. And certainly in this opera, in the character of Salome, we have probably, to put it mildly, the most disturbed person that had inhabited the opera stage up to that point, well beyond Lady Macbeth or Lucia de Lammermoor or any of the mad heroines that you'd seen in opera. This was a woman who was obsessive, and for the role, Strauss said that what he wanted was sort of improbable. He wanted a 16-year-old princess with the voice of Isolde. And what he got was this woman here, Marie Wittig, who almost quit because she found the part so difficult. Now there's, she's a pretty hefty person there. Wouldn't want to meet her in a dark alley necessarily. But Marie Wittig, this is, she premiered the role of Salome and one of the most demanding and difficult roles in opera. And I just want to play you a little excerpt from it. What you'll hear in this is this very lavish, huge orchestra and a very expansive and kind of, well, expressionistic vocal part. This is right at the end of the opera, after the head of John the Baptist has finally been given to her, and she's kissed it, which she wanted to do when he was alive. And so this is the final moments of the opera where she says, what's it all about? What have I really gotten? I have kissed your mouth, Yochanan. I have kissed your mouth. And then Herod tells the soldiers to murder her. They crush her with their shields. And I just want to point out, and I'll do it by just indicating it with a flash of light at the moment. Right after she finishes singing, we have probably the most dissonant chord that had ever been played up to that time. It's been described as a sickening dissonance in a way, this clash of harmonies as she finishes her monologue. This is the end of a fairly long monologue. So I'll flash when that extremely dissonant chord comes. So this is the end of Strauss's Salome. Thank you. So while Einstein was sitting in his study writing the theory of relativity in 1905, audiences were shocked to see Salome waving the head of John the Baptist around on stage and kissing it in that way. And as you heard, the dissonance is kind of pretty intense there. Strauss did not have the last word or the monopoly on expressionistic writing of this kind around the same time. Giacomo Puccini, the great opera composer, also could create a kind of intense psychodrama and heightened expression that was really not related to the German version at all. We often think of the operas of Puccini as the last of the bel canto tradition that came out of Bellini and Verdi. But in fact, Puccini is also a truly modern figure in many important ways. And the expressionistic writing, very powerful for voice and orchestra, particularly in his great opera of 1900, Tosca. I mean, Tosca, in her way, she's not crazy like Salome, but she's an intensely sort of expression-bound heroine. And the climax of the opera in this famous poster comes when she murders the man who's torturing her, Scarpia. And I just want to play you a bit of this. What you see here is, you'll hear again this kind of intense, heightened expression. This is the moment in Act Two where Scarpia, the villain, the police chief in Rome, is torturing Cavaradossi, her boyfriend, and he actually opens the doors so that she can hear him being tortured. And Scarpia shouts, gridando, torture him harder. And he's trying to get Tosca to reveal a secret of where the key is, this fellow Angelotti, Scarpia wants to get. So what you hear in this little excerpt is similar, but what's interesting in Puccini is that there is a bel canto. He found a way to keep heightened vocal lyricism of the Italian tradition at the same time as subsuming them into a kind of surging drama where people actually do shout, or somebody's being tortured, or somebody's shouting. And yet, one of the great things about Puccini's Tosca is this expressionistic writing where the orchestra and the voice together partake of this highly intense kind of language. So here's this excerpt, famous recording by Maria Callas. Another figure very central in this period, a contemporary of Strauss and Puccini, is Gustav Mahler, who avoided opera throughout his career as a composer, although his entire career was involved in conducting opera. His professional positions were in conducting opera houses in Hamburg, Budapest, and finally in Vienna, where he was the most prestigious opera company in Germany. In Austria, he was the head of the Hofoper. But for him, the main realm of expression was in the symphony and the song. He wrote symphonies and orchestral songs. And in his symphonies, he would take this expression to new heights, often by taking genres or, let's say, tropes or topoi with which people would have been familiar and throwing them into the symphony in a way where you don't expect them, or where they come in a way that you don't expect them. And I want to play you an excerpt from his Sixth Symphony from around this time, where it begins, Mahler's Sixth Symphony, with a march, an intense kind of gripping march, almost as though German militarism or something is being hitting you over the head. This is the beginning of Mahler's Sixth Symphony, which is a march. March goes beyond any march you would have heard in Beethoven, the Turkish March in the Ninth Symphony, or the Funeral March in the Eroica Symphony. This is, again, the height of expression in this way. Another genre that Mahler used in this way, you might say, was an Austrian dance, the Ländler, which was a kind of triple time, well, it was a triple time dance, three, 4 meter, very kind of earthy. And in the Fifth Symphony, the middle movement begins as a Ländler, but again, like Ländler cubed or very intensified. Here's the Fifth Symphony. Thank you. Person who you saw in the photograph earlier, a real pioneer whose theories I discussed, Arnold Schoenberg, here in a painting by a contemporary Austrian expressionist named Richard Gerstel. Now, Schoenberg was a decade or so younger than Mahler or Strauss and really went even further in some of these directions. And interestingly, Strauss and Mahler had exactly opposite reactions to him. Strauss, after initially supporting Schoenberg, sort of pushed him aside. And there's a famous letter of recommendation, if you want to call it that, that Strauss wrote for him saying, well, you can give Schoenberg this grant, but he should really be shoveling snow, he said. Whereas Mahler was a great supporter of Schoenberg and really stood up for him in Vienna, where he was. There's a famous story where Mahler was attending a concert where one of Schoenberg's quartets was being performed. And as people often did in time in Vienna, they stood up and hissed. They either hissed or they blew on their house keys. There must have been something about the shape of the Viennese house keys that allowed them to do that. And so somebody stands up, or more than one person stands up and starts hissing. And Mahler was furious because he really had a kind of paternal feeling for the younger composer, Schoenberg. And he stood up and he said to this person, how dare you hiss? Or who are you to hiss? And the person said, oh, that's okay. I hiss at your symphonies too, he said to Mahler. That really happened, that story. Schoenberg, as I said, did go further in these ways. And on tonight's program, for those of you who are coming to the concert, his second string quartet, which was composed in 1907, it's interesting because it's a conventional genre, the string quartet, like the symphony was for Mahler, but radically reimagined in the way that Mahler reimagined the symphonies. And in the scherzo movement of this piece, it's virtually atonal, that is, the dissonance is emancipated, but there's a marvelous moment when the movement reaches its sort of height of dissonance, and out of this dissonance emerges an Austrian folk tune, a Ländler, which everybody would have been familiar with then. In fact, some of you might be. O du lieber Augustin. Dum, da, 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 dum, 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 which was a well-known Austrian folk tune. And the last few words of that phrase are alles ist hin, alles ist hin, which means everything's gone, or, you know, it's not there anymore, everything's away. And Schoenberg quotes this little tune, and it dissolves, as though he's saying that these traditions, these conventions, these rules that we thought had all been in place are gone. So it's a kind of musical statement about what's happening in the music of the time. So here's this passage from Schoenberg's second string quartet. Just dissolves back into atonality there. The last movement of Schoenberg's string quartet, which is, I think, we're just going to hear that movement tonight, very unusual. In the last two movements of his string quartet, number two, he uses a soprano. He brings in a soprano, an unprecedented kind of thing to do in a piece of chamber music like this. And the soprano sings poems, sings settings of poems by Stefan Georga, a very important expressionist, sort of symbolist poet of the time. And this poem in the final movement is called Entrückung, or Transport. And it's actually a wonderful sort of metaphor for us here today at the Einstein Fest, because the metaphor is one of sort of lack of gravity, or floating free of gravity. She says, I feel the air of another planet. Faces that once looked at me in a friendly fashion are now looking at me very palely. They've turned away from me, she says at the beginning. And Schoenberg uses this metaphor, you might say, to create a kind of music that floats free of gravity, floats free of tonality. And I'm going to play you a bit of the very opening of the last movement, where he manages to create, with just the four instruments of a string quartet, this sense of floating, circling, floating free. And then you'll hear where the soprano comes in singing these words that are the first three lines there. And then I'm going to cut to the end of the movement, where we'll hear this sort of expressionist style of singing, where she sings, I am only the spark of a holy, of a sacred fire. I'm only the roar of the holy voice. So it's a remarkable metaphor or musical capturing of a metaphor of this kind of floating free of gravity with this new kind of atonal emancipated music. So first the violins or the string quartet at the opening, and then her entrance, and then the end of the movement. Thank you. amazing, amazing moment. And you'll hear that tonight, one of the great chamber works of the early 20th century from 1907. I wanted to just talk briefly about one of Schoenberg's. Schoenberg had two very famous pupils. One was Alban Berg, the other was Anton Webern. And what happens right after this, including Schoenberg himself, is that the musical language, in a way, becomes atomized and very compressed. It's now completely atonal, in a sense, but it also becomes very condensed, in a way. And I wanted to play you a piece that Anton Webern wrote, his five pieces for orchestra, Opus 10. In this particular piece, the orchestra consists only of nine instruments: a clarinet, a trumpet, a trombone, a mandolin, a celesta, a harp, a snare drum, and a solo violin and solo viola. So it's like a atomized orchestra. And the writing is very pointillistic, very individual lines, gestures coming in and out. It lasts only, this whole movement lasts only 28 seconds. That was long for Webern. But what you'll hear is it's still very expressive, but it's like expression condensed into individual gestures. So here's this very unusual orchestra piece by Webern. Mandolin. Schoenberg told him to make it shorter, but no, only kidding. I might have a moment. I just put the score up here. He wrote also for string quartet in this very similar style, and you can almost see, even if you can't read music, perhaps. Can you see the these tiny little melodic gestures that? This is a slow piece. This whole page lasts 2 minutes when it's played. I'll just play a bit of it, and you can hear how, in the realm of the string quartet, he does something similar. Just a little bit of it. I'll just play that bit. Schoenberg had a term for this kind of, particularly in the previous piece I played you, he called it Klangfarben melody, or tone color melody. That is, the melody is not created out of any conventional thing, but out of a succession of tone colors. In the previous piece, that was particularly apparent, where mandolin has one gesture, celesta another, violin. But even in this piece that I've just played you, again, no long-breathed melodies, no traditional harmonies. Although you have melody and you have harmony, but the dissonance has been emancipated in this way. So those are some examples of the more expressive language. The second area I wanted to talk about is the ways in which folk music becomes a very important device or kind of way for composers in the early modern period to create an individual musical language. And one of the works we'll hear on tonight's program is Béla Bartók's first string quartet from 1908. And Bartók was one of the first people to actually use folk music, not in a way that's simply, not for local color, so to speak. He didn't just try and create a sort of happy little folk dance in the middle of a symphonic work, which is more the way, say, Dvorak or earlier composers had. For him, Bartók actually went out into the field. He was one of the first ethnomusicologists we can say. He actually believed that you should see what folk music is like among the people, and there's this remarkable picture of him with this very early phonograph. That's Bartok there with the peasant girl, having her sing into this machine. And he recorded these people sort of staring at the camera, undoubtedly the first camera they'd ever seen. This is in the first decade of the 20th century. And Bartok in his first string quartet is an interesting that it's clearly related to the traditions of Beethoven. It begins, the quartet does, with a slow fugue, a slow imitative kind of polyphony, which is very traditional. It's pretty much atonal, but it's still very much related. And I have an excerpt here that shows the opening of Bartok's string quartet, and then after a bit of silence, the opening of Beethoven's C-sharp minor quartet, on which it is clearly based. The Beethoven quartet also begins with a slow fugue, a slow imitative polyphony. So here's the opening of Bartok's first quartet that you'll hear tonight. There's no folk music in this part. This is a classical tradition. Beethoven. Stop that there. So the other side of this quartet, so to speak, though, is it's one of the first places in his work where Bartok uses folk music in a way that was to become very typical from him. And I have excerpts from the third movement of this piece. What you heard was from the first movement. It starts with a melody, a kind of very dissonant accompaniment in minor seconds buzzing along, and then a folk-style melody that comes in. And then after a little break, I'll play you a melody that is even closer to folk style. It's a pentatonic melody, a melody using a special scale, pentatonic scale, a five-note scale that was very typical of much folk music. And this is the third movement of Bartok's first quartet, integrating folk music into his musical language. Now the pentatonic melody, 5 minutes. Thank you. very, very beautiful use of the folk material. Bartok's contemporary, and one of his models for this, was the great Russian composer Igor Stravinsky, who also, right around the same time, he was just a teeny bit older than Bartok, used folk music in his ballets in particular in ways that, again, for both these composers, it was a path to modernism right around this time. It was a way to make music sound modern and give it national identity at the same time. And what I'll just play you one example from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring from 1913, the path-breaking ballet. And what Stravinsky does is he chooses folk melodies. The last one we heard from Bartok was kind of wide and expansive and melodic. Stravinsky tends to choose themes that have only three or four notes very close together. So already they're very kind of compressed, and he manipulates them with rhythms that are very irregular and dissonances underneath. So it's based on folk material, but it's much less kind of melodic folk material. So this is from the Rite of Spring of 1913. Here comes a folk melody in the bassoons. Very three or four notes. There's many other examples one could use of this kind of thing, but I'd like to move on to talk about another area. I talked about musical expression, use of folk music. The third is, I might categorize as fascination with exploration of relationship between the arts at this time, particularly music and the visual arts. There was a real attempt on the part of different artists to explore the boundaries, the connections between these arts. And one of the pioneers in this regard was the Russian painter Vasily Kandinsky, who was trained in Germany, in Munich, and worked in Germany, and is effectively a founder of German expressionist and German abstract art. And this is a wonderful painting that he did in 1911. And the reason that I show it to you is it was based on a concert. He called it Impression 3 Concert, the concert at which he first heard Schoenberg's music. And it made such an impression on him that he went back the next day, or went back to his studio and painted this painting, and then wrote a fan letter to Schoenberg. This is in 1911, Kandinsky. And this painting is wonderful because you get a sense of the concert. I'll just step away and... this is obviously the piano, and there's the pianist. This is the audience. And at this concert was also performed Schoenberg's second string quartet, the one you'll hear part of tonight. And people argue about this, but I think you can maybe make out the soprano and some string players here. But the whole thing is, of course, tending toward abstraction in an important way. And particularly striking is this huge yellow triangle here, which has no obvious representational. I mean, you can see the audience, the pianist, the piano thing, but this is a huge abstract element. And for Kandinsky, colors had specific musical attributes. He was genuinely synesthetic. It has been pretty much established that he could actually sort of hear colors or see sounds. He was one of, along with some other people today, as then, for him, he wrote in his famous book On the Spiritual and Art, "Keen lemon yellow hurts the eye in time as a prolonged and shrill trumpet note the ear." And when he describes the qualities of the color yellow, he talks about it striving toward the viewer, sort of leaping out of the canvas. And you get that sense here. He actually also wrote a stage play, Kandinsky, one of the first expressionist stage plays, called The Yellow Sound, Der Gelbe Klang, which sort of says it all in a way. And he had certain theories about black, too. He wrote that black has musical properties, a totally dead silence, a silence with no possibilities, which might not entirely apply in this painting since it is the source of some of the sound. But again, these ways in which sound and color were very much associated for Kandinsky. Another person for whom that was the case was the Russian composer Alexander Scriabin. He wrote works that combined color and sound, and he actually associated them. For his work Prometheus, he actually created a color organ. And this is a composite of showing, I don't know that he quite put it together this way, but somebody's put it together this way, showing for him the associations between color, key, and mood, so to speak, or idea. For Scriabin, who was also synesthetic, genuinely, these were real things to explore in music. And this is something that he, around 1911, around this time, he actually created an instrument that would associate light and sounds in specific ways. And this is an example of one of the things he explored. So that was a big thing around this time. Another person who had a strongly visual imagination in music was Claude Debussy. Certainly, when we talk about musical impressionism, that's a pretty valid kind of thing to talk about with Debussy. And he often was associated with the impressionist musics and painters. And here's a little piano piece that he wrote. They often had titles called voile, or sails, in which he gets a kind of floating quality too, like floating on the water, but with means very different from Schoenberg. He uses a whole tone scale, a different kind of scale, which is sort of atonal, but not as dissonant. Painted musically, or composed painterly, as well as any figure at this time, Claude Debussy. One other example of a different aspect of music at the time, I would call this my fourth area, was interest in the music of the past. Modernists did not turn their back or reject the past. In many ways, they tried to reinvent it. And Max Reger, who's not much thought about these days, actually, but in his day was recognized along with Strauss and Mahler and Schoenberg as a leading modernist, was deeply attached to the music of Bach, the music of Beethoven, and he forged a modernist style out of using the materials of the past, particularly Bach. And I wanted to just, Reger was one of the great organ composers of the time. In fact, he really led a revival of organ. And I want to play you a teeny bit of an organ fugue that he wrote. And this was written around 1905, 1906. And it almost sounds like a throwback to Bach, but not quite, because it's much more modern in its style. So a fugue, a piece of imitative organ polyphony of the kind that Bach would have written, but now updated to 1905.
Thank you.
So a number of different ways that composers around 1900 tried to forge a new language, heightened expression, use of folk music, use of visual effects or correspondence between visual aspects and music, and the use of the past. My final examples that before I close and take some questions, if you have them, is you might almost say music as social commentary, or music as reflecting the current political and cultural situation. And in Einstein's day, in 1905, there was a strong sense, as I implied in my title to this talk, of being between two eras, between a kind of romantic or late romantic and a modernist. And great tension was felt. There was definitely a cultural tension there. The old world was rapidly vanishing with new technologies, with urbanization, the advance of sciences, very strong at the end of the 19th century. And the poet Ugo von Hofmannsthal, great Viennese poet, had a term for what he felt was this kind of sense of something slipping away, or that the past slipping away, and he called it das Gleitende, what slips away. And for him, it was almost like a pre-existentialism in a way, of having trouble grasping onto the present because the past is moving into the present so fast in a way. And I think it's communicated somewhat in the music of the time that we've already heard. Certainly Mahler's March, his Ländler, and Schoenberg's O du lieber Augustin, the sense of something slipping away, Gleitende. Perhaps there's no better symbol of this within Austro-German culture than the treatment of the waltz which was the dance par excellence, invented in the 19th century as a kind of courtly version of the Ländler, or at least a upper class version. And of course, the great master of the waltz, Johann Strauss, the waltz king, the author of the Blue Danube, Wiener Blut, to which people danced, to which people listened across the 19th century, this great symbol of Vienna. And what we have at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, are ways in which the waltz kind of disintegrates in some pieces. And I want to just close with two examples of what I take to be a kind of musical Gleitende, it's a musical slipping away. One is in Richard Strauss in the waltzes that he wrote for this great opera in 1910, Der Rosenkavalier, which evoked the Viennese waltz better than anybody ever had in the modern way. But it's like over the top. The waltzes tend to have instruments that poke out from the texture. They tend to get dissonant. They tend to be sort of too extreme. So it's a sense in which the waltz is exaggerated. So from Der Rosenkavalier, his collaborator in this great opera was Hugo von Hofmannsthal. That was the librettist for Der Rosenkavalier. And if anything, among other things, that opera is an emblem of the slipping away of this culture. But even more extreme is this great piece that Maurice Ravel wrote in 1912, just a couple of years later, La Valse, this magnificent orchestral piece which ends with basically a train crash of a waltz. My final example for you today will be the very end of La Valse, in which it's almost like an emblem of this great culture kind of hitting a wall in a very violent way, even much more so than Strauss. So here's the ending of Ravel's La Valse from 1912. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Walter. We have time for a couple of very brief questions, if there are any from the audience. If you'd like to raise your hand and we'll bring you a microphone. We have a little bit of time constraint just because of our concert tonight. But if there are, I'm not trying to discourage you, if there are a couple of questions, we'd be happy to take one question right here.
You've shown us how the artists and the music overlapped, say, in the Kandinsky painting, but is there any evidence of the science actually overlapping or influencing the musicians? I mean, did Schoenberg understand Einstein any better than anybody else?
I don't know that Schoenberg understood Einstein better than anyone else. Schoenberg was definitely interested in acoustical. I mean, there was a lot of interest in acoustical theory, and Schoenberg talked about microtones and that kind of thing, and mentioned certain physicists in, I think, in the Harmony Lyra as well. He was certainly aware of Einstein, but I'm not sure how much actual musicians sought to, maybe Scriabin. I'm not sure how much the actual German musicians were aware of the technicalities of the scientific revolution. So they were interested. I mean, somebody like Schoenberg, I know a little bit more about him than other people. Strauss, unlikely, but Schoenberg definitely was interested in laws of physics and acoustics, and in fact, he made appeal to the law of the overtones, which wasn't new at the time, but to defend his emancipation of the dissonance, but also to talk about alternative scales and alternative ways of hearing the sort of musical system.
Another question, now that I've inhibited everybody. Question up there.
Schoenberg is almost exclusively associated with atonality, but I'm just wondering, didn't he have a period there where he's very tonal and very melodious prior to that stage?
He certainly did. He grew out of late Romanticism as authentically as anybody. His early works sound very much like Brahms, his early chamber works. He learned music he was self-taught largely, Schoenberg, but he played in a string quartet, he played the quartets of Schoenberg, Beethoven, and Brahms. He was deeply, deeply attached to that tradition. Then in the 1890s, he got to learn Wagner's music and appreciated that. But some of Schoenberg's earliest music is very redolent of Brahms. And then the piece that I mentioned that was played on the concert that Godowsky picture, Verklärte Nacht from 1899, is a kind of synthesis of Schoenberg and Brahms. It's a string sextet, it's a piece of chamber music, such as you might hear from Brahms, but it's filled with Wagnerian harmonies. So Schoenberg saw definitely, and he never felt that when people would ask him, how do you compose, or what is your music like? He would often point them to Verklärte Nacht, and he says, I never composed any differently than that. People have misunderstood that I was seeking atonality. He hated the word atonality, by the way. He thought atonal, it's not atonal. Atonal implies the absence of tones. There are tones. He would have preferred the term pantonality, but it never caught on. but he definitely saw himself as part of a continuum, and he often spoke of being sort of pushed in this direction that he took in the second string quartet, a kind of historical and inner compulsion to carry the musical language further. But basically, he did not see what he was doing, and it wasn't, in many ways, as a revolution. The final chord, you'll hear tonight, the final chord of Entrückung, the second string quartet, is a glorious F sharp major. After all that happens in that piece, it ends back on the planet Earth, so to speak, in tonality, F sharp.
One last quick question. Last question up there.
You mentioned that a lot of these musicians were very interested in the times with politics and culture. Now, so these people thought a lot about that. Did they ever, other than produce art that reflected that, did they ever get their opinions across to, say, the masses or many people to create change or anything, or is it just kind of left in the vault of their music?
That's a very good question. There were a number of artists who were strongly socially committed. Schoenberg himself, oddly, was sort of a monarchist and a real conservative in that way. But he also wrote music for the Workers' Party and had strong associations with socialist movements for a while. And believed in that. They tended to work through music or musical organizations. I mean, you know, well, for one thing, most of them were Jewish, which didn't get you very far. In fact, just the opposite in Vienna. I mean, Mahler, even though he had converted to Catholicism, basically Mahler was run out of town in 1907 from his position at the head of the Viennese opera because he was Jewish. Schoenberg had a similar problem, like Einstein later. So. But there certainly was an association with leftist movements on the part of some of these people. But more often, I think it was through their music. Strauss was very apolitical, unfortunately, as we know. He stayed in Germany throughout the Nazi period and just sort of dug his head in the sand. For Schoenberg, that would not have been a choice. For many others, it wasn't. So the political side of things was very present for these people, but they tended to, you know, carry it out through their art, you might say, more, if that answers. I mean, certainly later, Schoenberg's works, Survivor from Warsaw, I mean, there's strong political content to Schoenberg's, like Moses and Aaron. I mean, it's a lot about his Judaism. Later on with Schoenberg, there's a direct connection between religion and politics because he was a big supporter of the founding of the State of Israel and music in his later works.
And on that note, I'd like to, again, Walter Frisch, thank you very much for a great lecture. Just before you go, if Shirley Duick is here, could you please see Barbara down here? If you're coming to our concert tonight, you're in for a big treat. Thank you for coming this afternoon, and please exit at the top to your left. Thank you.